Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Catherine Brigantino, and I'm joined today by Steve Romanin, who's teching the show for us. So thank you, Steve. And I'm also joined by Daniel Angrenon, who worked really hard to produce this show. So a big thank you to you as well, Dan. Today, we will be joined by Juliana Ferreira from SOS Fauna in Brazil. But first, I have a quick news piece for you. This piece comes to us from the Huffington Post and is titled "McRib Lawsuit Pits Humane Society Against Smithfield Farms, McDonald's Over Animal Welfare." The Humane Society of the United States announced this week that it had filed an SEC complaint against Smithfield Farms, the large pig producer that supplies pork for McDonald's divisive limited edition McRib sandwich. The complaint, which is posted in its entirety online, alleges that the pigs' living conditions are cruel and unusual, citing reports of pigs covered in blood and sows being confined to tiny gestation crates, which are illegal in some states. This isn't the first time animal rights groups, or even the HSUS, has targeted Smithfield for its record on animal welfare. In December 2010, the HSUS got a hold of gruesome footage of a Smithfield Farms facility, leading respected figures like Mark Bittman to call for a boycott of meat from the company. Indeed, this most recent complaint seems more like the latest salvo in an ongoing dispute than like a breaking development specifically occasioned by the McRib. An unsympathetic analysis of the HSUS action would probably lead to the conclusion that the group is tying its complaint to the McRib in order to drum up public attention for the cause. The sandwich, after all, has long been a lightning rod for press coverage. That's not to say that the McRib is some kind of pristine product of nature, of course. Before the HSUS complaint surfaced, several media outlets had conducted investigations into the myriad of bizarre ingredients that go into the boneless rib patty at the center of the sandwich. The pork bits that make up the meat include tripe, heart, and scalded stomach, which is bad enough, but the chemical additives that go into the sandwich are even worse. Allegedly, when the additives aren't binding lung and liver bits together, they're used for keeping yoga mats springy and shoe soles white. Nice, interesting piece of news, again, from the Huffington Post. I am joined by Juliana Ferreira, a PhD candidate in conservation genetics at the Laboratory of Evolutionary Biology and Vertebrate Conservation at Sao Paulo University in Brazil. Juliana works closely with SOS Fauna, an organization which fights the illegal wildlife trade in Brazil. Welcome to Animal Voices, Juliana.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved with SOS Fauna?
I was doing my master's, actually, and I was just researching for some papers, and I came across the website of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife National Forensics Laboratory. And I found out that there was something called forensic science applied to wildlife crimes. And I was in love with that. And around the same time, a professor at the University of São Paulo introduced me to Marcelo Rocha, who is the president of SOS Fauna. And he began teaching me all he knew after 20 years of experience working with wildlife trafficking in Brazil and showing me the reality and showing me how life was outside of the lab. And I was in love with the subject, and being a graduate student, I just learned that there was wildlife forensics. I was learning about wildlife trafficking, and I knew I wanted to do something with those things.
So you said you were in love with wildlife crimes in a forensic laboratory setting. Why do you say you were in love?
Because science is such an important and strong tool to fight crimes. And crimes against wildlife are nowadays among the worst conservation issues. And it's funny because some people, they feel so distant from biodiversity and conservation and environment, but it's just that they have no idea how healthy ecosystems affect our life and our quality of life and our future and the future of our children. And also they don't think about the right of life and of well-being of animals. So when you start really fighting crimes against wildlife, when you start really thinking about healthy environment and healthy animals and the well-being of animals and giving value to life, I just felt that it was something so important, so relevant to be done. And I think that when scientific data is used in legal processes, it just makes it more serious and it minimizes the error margin. Because sometimes when you're dealing with opinions and ideas, the process can go either way. But when you have a scientific fact, it gives you a direction. And I just think that it's about time we start taking crimes against wildlife seriously and understanding how important it is for us that ecosystems are healthy and animals are fulfilling their functions in the wild. So. Mm.
I definitely want to ask you more about the scientific process that is used to protect mm-hmm. these animals. But first, I'm wondering if we can just talk about the animals themselves. Who exactly are the victims of animal trafficking in Brazil?
There is a very big NGO called Henctas, and they did a very interesting report. It's the first document in Brazil about wildlife trafficking. And I like to use their how they catalog wildlife trafficking. So we can divide wildlife trafficking in Brazil in different divisions, different fronts. So there is the wildlife trafficking to supply mainly pharmaceutical companies, and it's the biopiracy and also the cosmetic industry. And this kind of wildlife trafficking targets mainly poisonous animals and, of course, plants, and they're looking for some active principle that can be used in medicine or cosmetics. So they take hundreds of thousands of little wasps and bees and whatever spiders they can take, and they just search for this active principle, trying to synthesize that in the lab and then sell drugs and medicine to us, not paying any royalties, not giving anything back, and just making us pay big money for that drug. There is also the traffic to supply zoos and collectors. And this targets mainly animals which are usually rare and endangered and very, very expensive. So it usually deals with a smaller number of individuals, but these individuals are very important because sometimes they are among the last ones in the wild populations, and they are very important genetically to being the wild. One case that everybody knows about this is the extinction of the little blue macaw in the nature. And mainly, the little blue macaw was extinct not only because of habitat loss and degradation, but because it was so targeted by collectors. And now, if I'm not mistaken, there are, 30 or 40 individuals in breeders and with collectors around the world.
Just to clarify, there are 40 breeders of little blue macaws?
It's not breeders. No, 40 individuals in collectors. I just used the wrong word. I'm sorry.
So that means individual birds?
Yeah.
Wow.
But I'm not sure if this number is correct. I know it's less than 50, I guess. People have been trying to breed them. I don't know if they were successful or not, but it's just a few animals left only in collectors. So,
okay.
Yeah. And then there is also a very big wildlife trade for products made of animal parts. So here we can use as an example souvenirs, but also religious charms and luck charms. So, for example, a comb made of a turtle that a tourist will buy here. Or, for example, people here have a They believe strongly in traditional medicine, so they believe that if they use an animal's genitalia, they will have more kids or they will bring the loved one. So this is a very, very big trade. And finally, the traffic to supply the pet market. People here in Brazil and around the world, I'm sure you know that, they just love to have wild animals. They are not satisfied giving a home to a rescued dog or cat. They want to have a wild species at home. And while there are some breeders that supply animals, these are still wild species, and the animals from breeders are more expensive and in a fewer number. So the great majority of the animals to supply the pet market are just withdrawn from nature. And that's the area where I work more closely with.
You said that people aren't interested in perhaps adopting a dog or a cat, and they just love wild animals, and that's why they're actually taken out of their habitat. Why is that? I mean, what can you tell us about why people prefer to actually take animals out of the wild?
I don't have that answer, and if I did, it would be easier to, you know, attack this problem. But I think that, at least here in Brazil, it's a huge cultural issue that I believe it was mainly inherited from indigenous people. They always carried macaws, they had animals. And I just think that wild animals have this, they're cool to have. Oh my God, you have a boa, you have a python, you have a macaw. And it's different. And I think that because dogs and cats are domesticated, they're seen as normal. So it's not cool or different. So I think that it's maybe the search for individuality and being different. I don't know. I just think it's, I don't know, it's people who need to fulfill this weird vanity that they don't think about the animal well-being. They don't think about evolutionary processes. They don't think about conservation. They just want to have a wild bird to look at, you know, stuck in a cage. And that's like slavery. I don't know.
I'd say that's a fair analogy. I wanted to return to the issue of animals being captured to supply the cosmetic and pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. When we think about pharmaceutical industries and exploitation of animals, I tend to think of the animals who are actually being tested on. And I think this is definitely something that I have overlooked, that, you know, animals are actually captured from the wild to supply the cosmetic mm-hmm. and pharmaceutical industry. Can you tell us more about this?
I don't have numbers about this, and this is not the main area that I work on. So okay. What I can tell you is what I've been hearing and seeing from people that really work on this field. Yes, there is still capture for animal testing, but I also think that for many mammals, it's not that difficult to breed them in captivity. I'm against animal testing whatsoever, from captivity, from a breeder, or from the wild. But I think that nowadays there is a little bit more control and people will not just accept anything. But yes, according to the Ranktas report, there is still lots of captures, mainly of monkeys, for animal testing. The other little mammals, I think they are probably mostly bred for that. Not that this is a good thing.
So what is the largest problem when it comes to wildlife trafficking? What area?
I think that this varies around the world, but I think that mainly the trade to supply the market for products of animal parts and the trade to supply the pet market, I think they are the worst. Because if you think about pharmaceutical companies and biopiracy itself, not thinking about the animal testing, we're talking about thousands of animals, but they're little wasps, little spiders. And the impact may be huge, but on the same time, the impact may not be so huge just because these animals produce so many offspring. Mm. But nowadays, you know, it's just a huge, huge ever-growing market, both to own wild animals as pets and also to own ivory material and skin from animals and trophies. And here in Brazil, you go to the traditional market, it's easy to see animal feet, animal eyes, and oils made of animals, and all these things, and all these religious souvenirs. So I would say the products and the pet market, for sure.
Mm. I'm wondering if you can paint a picture for us about the journey that animals go through to actually get to the people who are buying them. And I wonder if we can just start with the methods of capture, if you mm-hmm. could tell us about that.
Yes, it also varies according to the species and the place, but mainly people who are not hungry, but they are very, very poor. They live in rural areas in Brazil. They usually capture animals. They can capture birds using mist nets. They can actually capture them using another animal from that species to attract them. And they can use food. So they lay out fruits and other kinds of food, but they use a sort of a glue. So when the animal perches to eat the food, they get stuck. And they get stuck with the feathers and they get all hurt. So, but it will vary. If we're talking about ornamental fish, which is also very, very exploited, then they for sure use nets and other kinds of strategies. But mainly poor people, usually excluded from the state action. They don't have good access to health care, to education, but they're not hungry anymore. They're not dying for hunger. They usually capture these animals in rural areas. And they sell some of these animals very, very cheaply in small local fairs in these rural areas as well. They usually trade these animals. Let's say they trade a couple of birds for 5 cents each, 10 cents each. Maybe if they trade it very expensively, they will get $1 for each bird, for example. And then these animals are taken to other local fairs, a little bit bigger in bigger cities, but still close to rural areas. And here, the big criminal comes into scene because it's a guy who leaves a big city from Brazil, for example, São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro. They go to these medium-sized cities close to the rural areas. They go to these small fairs in which are sold all sorts of food and stuff for the kitchen and also animals. And they start to buy these animals also very, very cheaply, say, I don't know, $5 the most. But what they do is they start to build medium-sized, big cargoes. The cargoes can be of, I don't know, 100 animals to up to 3,000 animals. And they will transport these animals either in cars, buses, or even trucks full of animals. And they transport these animals throughout Brazil in all directions, but mainly from the northeast and the center-west to the southeast, where São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro are. These cargoes get to the cities, and they are taken again to small fairs in the outskirts of the cities, where they are sold in all these little fairs, and people just take them home thinking that they are just buying a beautiful bird. So we're talking about huge cargoes. We're talking about animals taken regularly from the wild, and when they sell these animals in the outskirts of São Paulo, they can sell for, I don't know, $50 and even more. So if he paid initially $1 to $5, he's going to sell these animals, this 100 to 3,000 animals, for $50. And if he gets caught, almost nothing happens to him. So it's highly profitable. It's an ever-growing market. And it's just the best business ever for them.
Mm. So it seems like the people who are doing the trapping and the capture of birds aren't necessarily the ones that are making the most money.
Not at all. Quite the opposite. There are people who are excluded from society, you know? So there is no state presence in these places. There is no education. There is no health. There is no stable source of income. For these people, what we need to do are serious social politics of inclusion, of social inclusion. These people need education. These people need a stable source of income. These people need the presence of the state and of the civil society. They are not getting anything from it. They're getting a couple of bucks at the most. And they are not criminals. They are part of the system. They're victims of the system, you know?
Is there an effort in Brazil to work with the people who capture animals and provide economic alternatives to participating in the illegal wildlife trade?
Yes and no. There is a desire to be included, of course. Everyone wants a stable source of income and everyone wants education and good health. But on the other hand, while the majority of people, I believe, would be interested in that, for them, catching animals and selling is just so easy, and it would be an addiction to their income. So some of these people, I think, would never stop to do it just because, you know, they lay out the cages, they put the food, and in the end of the day, they can see what they got. Mm. So it's just kind of easy. But on the other hand, I have to be optimistic, otherwise I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And I think that if there is state presence and if there is a stable source of income, I think that some of them would definitely quit doing this. I think that this is possible in some places, of course, using the place as tourism and the people as tourist guides, like bird watching. But this is not possible in every small rural community all over Brazil. So I think that in each little city, in each little village, there is a unique characteristic. And it's just insane to go through all of those trying to figure out what they could do. Oh, these guys are going to produce pepper. These guys are going to produce handcraftsmen. These guys. So although I think it's possible, and I think the civil society, the society has to do something about it, I think it's hard to do it without the state and its massive presence and political will.
Mm. So just to clarify, the animals that are involved in illegal trafficking are turtles, iguanas, primates, but most of them are birds, correct?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. They are the all-time favorite ones. There is this statistics done by our environmental federal agency called the IBAMA. And they said that in one of the years, usually 85% of everything that it sees are birds, mainly songbirds and parrots and macaws.
I was wondering if we could talk about suppression of this illegal trafficking. You mentioned that really when people do get caught, there's really no consequences for them. Can you tell us more about the laws that are in place to protect the animals and how they are indeed failing them?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because we have laws that, in my view, they're conflicting. We have a law from 1967 that says that the state's responsible for taking care of wildlife and guarding it, mainly. But then we have the new environmental law from 1998 that it doesn't describe wildlife trafficking. So no one can be prosecuted for wildlife trafficking. What they can be prosecuted for is transportation without a permit, owning without a permit, and then in theory, they would pay a fine or answer, or it would become worse and worse according to the number of animals and if the species are endangered or not. But this law also sees environmental crimes as misdemeanor or minor crimes or lesser crimes. So actually no one goes to jail for it right now. And the fines, usually they reach the values like thousands, hundreds of thousands, and million reais. But it also, the law also says that the social status of the person has to be taken into account. And usually these people that do the wildlife trafficking, they claim to be from poor origin and they claim they have nothing. So usually, really in reality, what happens is because it's a lesser crime, a misdemeanor, the person does not go to jail. We take them to the police station when we catch them. We seize the animals, but they're just going to sign a document saying that they were there and this really happened, and that they will be in the presence of the judge when the judge says that the date comes. And usually the fines are around $70 to $100 tops, because they will not pay a fine. What it will happen is that because they say they are poor, this fine will be exchanged for what they call service to society. And parts of the service to society, service to community, is paying what we call food boxes. So we take a box, we fill with all the basic items of food like oil, rice, beans, and usually this costs around $100. So this person just pays one and donates it. So I am aware of, for example, a case where a man was, he was apprehended with a truck carrying 3,000 animals. His fine should be over $1 million and he should go to jail. But because he claimed he was from a poor origin and he couldn't pay for it, not only he did not go to jail and he did not pay the fine, he paid one $100 food box and he walked free. And you know what? Surprisingly enough, he was caught over 2 times again with over 1,000 animals, and the same happened. So we have a little bit of conflicting laws, and our society still looks at crimes against nature as misdemeanors, as lesser crimes.
Hmm. I wanted to return to the issue of, you know, the journey that animals go through to actually end up being bought. So we've talked about methods of capture, and at some point during transportation, that's where if people do get caught, they will be caught. But what are the conditions like in transportation?
It's horrible. The animals are transported under the worst conditions you can imagine. Of course, it's not in the trafficker's interest to lose his merchandise. So he'll do everything he can to keep the animals alive. Usually they know how to treat these animals. So they may arrive in their destinies alive, but they will be super stressed and dehydrated. So it's funny because when we catch the dealers, the animals are alive, but they are in horrible conditions and most of them will die short after. But it's not in the traffickers' interest to lose his merchandise. But usually the animals are carried in very, very small, tight boxes, usually very, very crowded. We find animals with legs broken, wings broken, beaks broken. They try to release themselves and they go against the cages and the bars. So usually they have wounds in their faces. They are super stressed, super dehydrated. They are usually in the heat for several days. You know, if you go in a big seizure and you see the cargo, it's an apocalyptic view because these individuals are alive. They're not only important for the ecosystem, but they have the right of life and well-being. And you can see the despair. You can see the fear. You can see the pain. It's all there. I'm not humanizing them. I'm not imagining those things. When you go in a seizure with live animals and you see the state of the animals, it's not possible to describe in words. It's like the doors of hell, and I'm not even Catholic. It's the worst possible thing to imagine that human beings who feel so forward and full of technology and who can produce beautiful masterpieces of art are capable of doing that to innocent living beings. So it's not a pretty picture at all.
We're all sort of just shaking our heads here. So what needs to happen for animals to end up in the care of SOS Fauna? Can you tell us more about that process and what SOS Fauna does for the birds that are seized?
Mm-hmm. What usually happens is we work very closely with São Paulo State Police. We have some very good, honest policemen that are just very interested for environmental issues. We work with them in the intelligence, trying to find the traffickers and know when they're going to come and trying to figure out where they live and where they leave the birds before they sell them and which trucks they're using. And we help them to set up all the operations and the raids. We also find the local small fairs where the animals are being sold. Sometimes we go to these fairs disguised to find the traffickers and find the dealers. So there's a whole investigative work which is carried out with the police that we do. And Marcelo Rocha, he's a genius. He disguises, he knocks on people's doors, he pretends he's selling stuff just to figure out if there are animals there. He hears the birds from the street and he figures out how many and which species are there. So it's an intelligence work.
Wow.
And then we help them during the seizures. You know, usually there are people running. I myself already caught a man twice as big as I was and I threw him to the ground because he was trying to run away. And we just give them a hand as much as we can. And it's very important that we are there because we help identifying which animals are legal and which animals are not legal. Because, for example, exotic animals are legal to own here in Brazil. So if there is an Australian parakeet, there's nothing we can do about it. So we have to identify which ones are, you know, Belgium canaries and finches and which ones are Brazilian animals. And also we perform the first aid because we came to understand that the first minutes, the first hours after the seizures are critical for the survival of the animals. So sometimes animals are seized and they're just, you know, left in the police station without care or water or heat or anything. So usually these animals die, I don't know, 80%, 90% of them die. But if we're there in the moment of the seizure and we immediately start to put them into clean cages and give them clean water and give them the proper food, then the survival is almost 100%. So that's something we do as well. And then the police deposit the animal with us. It's like they're saying, we are trusting you with these animals. So we take these animals back and, you know, usually this happens at night or in the weekends or very early in the morning on Sundays. And sometimes the governmental agencies are not even answering the phone and we are there receiving animals. Then we bring them to SOS Fauna. And at SOS Fauna, the animals who are first received, they have to stay in small cages and separated from the others as a quarantine to make sure they don't have any diseases that can spread. And they will receive veterinary first care. We're going to treat wounds. We're going to make them gain weight and eat the proper food and try to just make them strong. Once they're stronger and we realize they don't have any diseases, we just bring them to bigger flights where they can actually start using their muscles again, because usually they're not even using their muscles, you know, and they can fly, they can interact with other animals from the same species. And then from here, there is a dichotomy. Some of them cannot be released. So these will have the best life we can give them. They're going to be in big flights, and we're going to give them the best food we can find, and they're just going to be cared for. The other ones, which are the more important ones, which can be released, because releasing animals into the wild is a mess and it's difficult and it's very, very important to take all the care we can. These animals are going to receive specific care to be released, meaning that we have to minimize human contact. We have to start supplying them with the same food source they find in nature. We have to make periodic exams to make sure they're not developing any infections and they're strong. And we have to make sure they have aggressive behavior, they know how to search for food, that they are scared of predators. So if a hawk's flying above in the sky, we have to see if they're scared or not. And once they're ready, we can do the release of some of them. We call it reintegration, because we are reintegrating the animals as close as possible to their true origins, meaning they have to be released as closely as possible to where they were taken from, at least, at the very least, in the same biome. For the release of these birds, it really depends on the species, how it has to be carried out. But mainly we have to bring them to the place where they were seized, which is usually very far from us. We have to build these flights to leave them for a couple of weeks or months to make them used again to the climate, to the season, to the environment, to the noise, to the sun. And once they're adapted again, we just open the flight, but we still provide food for them. So they can fly away, but they still have a food source. And what we do, we just keep on putting this food source, but little by little, we put less and less and less, and we monitor them. We see if they are flying well, if they're eating well, if they're foraging, if they're hurt or not. And if they are all good, we just stop putting the food source and they're gone.
Just for listeners who don't know what you mean by a flight, can you explain what that is? I'm imagining it's a cage or...
It's a very, very big, big cage.
Okay, okay. Not a pet.
It's not. It's not even a cage. It's something on the outside that we build with fences. The animals, they have enough space to fly. There are many animals into each of those, so they can interact.
Oh, okay.
There is also some coverture that we do with branches. But the animals, they have enough space if they want to be in the sun, be in the shade, be in the rain, be not in the rain. So they're under the conditions of weather.
So they really regain choice. They get to make decisions about what they want to do that day, where they would like to eat, who they'd like to hang out with, which is something that was taken away from them. It sounds like SOS Fauna is able to sort of give them that back. What about the birds who are not able to be reintegrated? Why would a bird not be able to be reintegrated?
For the most various reasons. Some of them are just too hurt. Some of them have their wings badly hurt, or their legs badly hurt, or their eyes badly hurt. Some of them just show a weird compromised behavior. Some of them were in captivity for so long that it's hard to readapt. For example, if they're a parrot and they were in captivity for 20 years, it becomes a little bit difficult to readapt them. If they are sick, if it really, really, there are many reasons. And it's bad because if you think about it, these animals may even have a good quality of life. But I mean, they're animals who are supposed to be in the wild. Mm. We're never going to be able to give the quality of life they need. And also, if you think about it, they are genetically dead. They are biologically dead. They're not dispersing seeds. They're not reproducing. They're not fulfilling their ecological functions. So for the environment, they are dead.
At the top of the show, we talked about your interest in being involved with SOS Fauna as a way to bridge helping the animals that are victims of illegal wildlife trading by using scientific process. Can mm-hmm. you tell us, where does science fit in?
In many, many different levels. Right now in my PhD project, my objective was to study how the genetic variability was divided into some species. And if I indeed had different genetic groups, I wish to use genetic tools to assign animals seized from the illegal trade to their most likely populations of origin. That's one thing that we can use to make better releases and more responsible releases. But actually, science can play a very, very important role. And I have a dream, like my career goal. I wish to help Brazil to reestablish wildlife forensics here in Brazil. And I think that if we had a wildlife forensics laboratory, just like the US have, we could use scientific data in all different sorts of crimes involving wildlife. For example, analyzing a product which is made with animal parts and analyze if in this product some endangered species was used. And then you could fully prosecute the person responsible for that. So there is species ID, there is inference of geographical origin and population, there's gender ID. There are many, many questions that science can answer and provide scientific data for the legal process. Because sometimes crimes against wildlife are not even processed here. They're not even prosecuted because there's no information about it. Mm-hmm. If I give the police a little religious charm and I tell them, oh, here there is a piece of a cetacean or of a dolphin, they're going to say, how can I know? But if you test the species, we have tools to infer, you know, the cause of death of some animal. Is an illegal poison used to kill this animal? Is an illegal weapon used to kill this animal? So wildlife forensics can provide very important evidence for the legal process so that these crimes can be fully prosecuted and started to be taken seriously.
I came across your work in a TED Talk. And for those who don't know what TED Talks are, I really strongly recommend checking out their website, TED.com. Anyway, in your TED Talk, you say that the Brazil Ornithological Society, mm-hmm. and ornithology is the scientific study of birds, they say that we have too little knowledge about the birds and it would be too risky to release these animals for both the ones released and for the natural populations. Is this a fair claim? Can you tell us more about that?
The releasing process is very, very complicated. And I definitely, because I belong to the academia, I can see where they're coming from. When you release animals, you have to make sure at least that you're releasing as close as possible to their true population of origin. Because if indeed some species have different genetic populations, meaning that within one species, there are populations that are a little bit isolated and their genetics become a little bit differentiated. If you mix different genetic stocks, then we can have something called outbreeding depression, which is kind of when you mix things that are too different, they don't work well properly together, something like that. And that could decrease the fitness of the offspring. And also when you're releasing animals, we have to make sure we're not inserting any diseases in the natural populations. And at the same time, we have to make sure that the animals being released are strong enough to cope with all the environmental stress. We also have to make sure that there is enough food source and other resources for both the natural populations and the released animals. And we have to make sure that these animals, they are strong enough to fly and they know how to search for food, because I've seen releases here and I know about releases that, for example, 2,000 animals were released in the wrong way and the next day 1,500 were found dead.
Wow.
So if done wrong, releases can be harmful. So the Brazilian Ornithological Society follows what is ideal scientifically. And what is ideal scientifically is, for example, to understand the genetic structure of every single species all over the country. And this is almost impossible. So although I understand fully their scientific arguments. And although I think that some animals cannot be released at all, I believe that most can be released in a technically responsible way, mainly because, remember when I told you that Marcelo and SOS Fauna showed me how life is outside of the lab? Most of the people giving these opinions, they're very good scientists, but they do not know the day-to-day reality of wildlife trafficking. They do not see the hundreds and thousands of animals. So in the same TED Talk you mentioned, I had this calculation that I did, that only in the state of São Paulo, only in 2006, if we followed exactly what they said, we would have killed at least 26,000 birds only in 1 year. And I'm sorry, although I understand that it's important to have scientific rigor, I am a scientist, I believe in science, I cannot cope with something that would kill over 26,000 animals. And you know, in our legislation, the state is responsible for the well-being of the animal. Mm-hmm. The state failed when it let the animals being taken. It failed when it let the animals be transported. It failed when it let the animals be sold. So it cannot fail again and just murder these animals, because you know what? They call it euthanasia. For me, euthanasia is when you free a being from a pain which cannot be treated at all. But this would mean killing healthy animals. And this is murder. So although I understand that these are my colleagues, I cannot agree with that.
How do you respond to, well, in that same TED Talk, you said that the Brazil Ornithological Society also claims that simply too many resources are being spent on rehabilitating the birds. And mm-hmm. they, you know, and they do argue that instead they should be killed. And the number that you have calculated is absolutely disgusting. I mean, it's, at face value, it seems like a, you know, it's a legitimate concern. There's, and you've really helped us understand how complicated it really mm-hmm. is to reintroduce birds. How do you respond to that?
I think that yes, too many resources are spent in the rehabilitation. But for example, in SOS Fauna, we don't receive a single dime from the government. It's all from donors. It's all from our pockets. So although, yes, lots of money is spent in the rehabilitation of animals, as I told you, we fail them when we let them be caught. We fail them when we let them be transported. We fail them when we let them be sold. And you know what? I believe society has to pay the price, because if our society wants to be a society which buys wild animals, we are the ones doing the situation. We are the ones bringing this up on us. So I think that if this society wants to buy animals and wants to support this kind of trafficking, then the same society has to pay for the rehabilitation of the animals. And not only that, the same society has also to pay for conservation strategies and social inclusion politics to prevent this. Because you know what? Although I'm telling you that we can release animals in a responsible way, I have to say that we cannot look at releases as something beautiful. When you open the cage or the flight and the animal flies, we feel good. But this is not ideal. We're not supposed to be doing that. I want to live in a world where I'm not needed. You know, these animals were not supposed to be taken, be mistreated, and then be rehabilitated and then go back. We have to work on prevention. So yes, it is a legitimate worry that they have. But we as a society are responsible, so we have to pay the price.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, once animals are reintroduced, is there a chance that they're going to be recaptured?
There is a chance that they're going to be recaptured, and that's why the choice of the place of release is very, very important. But there is also a problem, which is not that they are going to be recaptured, but their offspring is going to be recaptured. Because, for example, when you're talking about parrots, the traffickers, they like to catch babies 1, 2, 3 days old. So if I release the big parrot group, I don't think they will be recaptured, but their offspring. So that's why we have to choose wisely where we are releasing these animals, but also we have to work. Okay, here's my formula. We have to work on prevention. So we have to work on 1, social inclusion in the rural areas and a stable source of income. Two, we have to work on enforcement and making the guys who are the real dealers and the real criminals pay the fines, go to jail, seize their cars, mess up with their pockets. And also education. We have to educate our children and our population in São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro why they are not supposed to buy these animals. Because I come from the university, every time we are in the police station, I talk to each and every one of the persons who are taken there. And I ask them, do you know why it is not allowed to own wild animals? Do you know why you shouldn't have this animal? And most of the times they know that it's not allowed, but they're clueless as to the real reasons. They think that we are just interested in making them pay fines and we want this money, or we want to be a pain in their life. And once you explain to them, the real impact of that, some of them cannot care less, but some of them will think about it and they will not do it again. And especially with the children. So yes, social inclusion in rural areas, punishment and enforcement for the real criminals and the dealers, and education for the consumer market. That's what we have to do. We have to work in all these fronts.
Juliana, we only have 1 minute left. Can you?
Oh, no.
I know. I'm sad this went so quickly. Can you please tell listeners how they can get involved with SOS Fauna if they would like to, and where they can find out more information?
Okay, we have a website. It's www.sosfauna.org. We are still working on the English version, but we already have some information in English. You can also go to the TED.com and find my talk, and there is my email there. There's my contact information, and all the help is welcome, because we are not counting with government. We need volunteer. We need people. We need people to talk to other people. We need to educate. We need help. So yeah, join us in this fight, because it's a fight worth fighting for.
And we will have those links available when the podcast goes on the website. Thank you so much, Juliana, for joining us. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We just spoke with Juliana Ferreira about her work with SOS Fauna. A big thank you to Daniel Angrenon for his hard work producing the show, Steve Romanen for teching, Neil Harvey and Aaron O'Sullivan for turning this interview into an MP3 for the podcast. And thank you for listening. Please visit our website, animalvoices.ca, to listen to this interview and over 300 others, or write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Stay tuned for Raw Sugar with Charissa.